movement politics, and social justice anywhere else on the radio. We can't do this without you. I'm here for you. WBAI is here for you. Please donate now. Go to give2wbai.org with the digit 2 in there. Give2wbai.org.
Tune in evenings at 5 p.m. for Tom Hartman on WBAI.
Thank you.
Elvis Costello from the extended version of Get Happy, covering a tune by I Wish I Knew. And this is WBAI New York. It is midnight. Coming up next will be Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Oh, hush you. Followed by a special edition of Hour of the Wolf without Jim Freund with Max Schmid, bringing you science fiction old-time radio from 1:30 to 3. Stay tuned. This is, once again, Earthwatch, coming up with Robert Knight.
Casting at 99.5 megahertz and streaming at stream.wbai.org. I'm Robert Knight. Next up is Earthwatch, with full spectrum coverage of the clandestine and overt wars against Syria, including an exclusive interview with United Nations correspondent Matthew Lee, senior reporter at Inner City Press. Also, independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont on war and econometrics and a geostrategic view of the energy issues surrounding the Syrian crisis. I'm Robert Knight, and this is Earthwatch. This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz and streaming at stream.wbai.org. I'm Robert Knight. Next up is Earthwatch, with full spectrum coverage of the clandestine and overt wars against Syria, including an exclusive interview with United Nations correspondent Matthew Lee, senior reporter at Inner City Press. Also, independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont on war and econometrics and a geostrategic view of the energy issues surrounding the Syrian crisis. I'm Robert Knight, and this is Earthwatch.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When the will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? When will we feel what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown, to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? We've been missing, that the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Long as there's life, there's still a day. Long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we now go to the United Nations with correspondent Matthew Lee, senior reporter with the investigative news organization Inner City Press. Welcome back, Matthew.
Sure, glad to be here, Bob.
Matthew, the United Nations has just released its report on recent alleged gas attacks in Syria. The American mainstream press, such as the Washington Post and New York Times and others, have subscribed to what we here call the news trance for escalation of the Contra war in Syria. Can you walk us through the report's major conclusions? And second, can you go through the caveats that were footnoted in the report that were elided from the American mainstream news trance?
Sure, absolutely. I think what's important is, for the first thing that's sometimes not included in these reports, is that the UN's mandate was never to decide or to even point to who used chemical weapons. Although they were sent to Syria to investigate actually an initial incident where Syria had complained the rebels had used weapons, and the mandate was simply to determine whether chemical weapons were used or not. The thing is that the date got closer, it became the people who had initially opposed them pointing the finger began to lobby Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to make such a finding. And I think I'm leading up to this by saying it was very telling that late last week, it was on a Friday, and this is while the UN was insisting that the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, had yet to see the report and was so had no comment on it. Ban Ki-moon, in what was called a closed meeting, but was mysteriously on UN television, declared that the report was overwhelming. And literally, I saw this on the sort of the UN's kind of in-house. It's still unclear whether they did this on purpose or not. It's starting to look like they did. I then went and asked at the noon briefing, you know, how could he, has he seen it yet? And the answer was no. So you have to ask yourself, how can the UN say a report is overwhelming before it's seen it? When the report did come out, it is, you know, its mandate, it points out that it's not determining who did what. And one of the major kind of caveats in it is to say, and I'm going to read this one to you, it's called Limitations. It's on page 22 of the report. And it says, the locations have been well traveled by other individuals prior to the arrival of the mission. Time spent on the site was well used, but limited. During the time spent at these locations, individuals arrived carrying other suspected munitions, indicating that such potential evidence is being moved and possibly manipulated. Now, that's a direct quote from the report itself. This is why some of us, at least, not only find it difficult to accept the Secretary General calling it overwhelming, but today it was called indisputable. And the only thing that's indisputable is that it has limitations. And so it's really kind of shocking to see kind of after the fact, and this is also, you know, I'm sure we can get into this in a moment, but this is after the U.S. and Russia kind of cut a deal already in Geneva. It's kind of a very weird process in which the kind of superpower deal on inspecting and seeking to remove chemical weapons from Syria has already been cut, and now you have the U.S. kind of in its own strange way, but especially France and the U.K. desperately pointing at this report and saying, we need a better deal, we need Assad in front of the International Criminal Court, we need to fund or arm the rebels more, and this is a report with its own built-in limitations.
Matthew, there may or may not be a difference between what happened with the original Iraq War and what is taking place now in regard to Syria. And in my opinion, to his shame, the former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan withdrew United Nations inspectors on the eve of war, and yet Ban Ki-moon in this particular case did not do that. Can you contrast that moment and this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the contrast really is, and again, sometimes, you know, in retrospect, people make Kofi Annan to be more independent than he was. For at least his first term, he was quite amenable to both the U.S. and French positions, but he's best known for, and I think should be known for, saying that the U.S.'s invasion of Iraq without Security Council approval was illegal. Now, they've tried to kind of backtrack on that because and say that he was tricked into saying it by somebody from a reporter. But he did say that, and he also, throughout that process, the U.N. sort of pushed back at the U.S. and its desire to go into Iraq. Here, it's entirely the opposite. I mean, the U.N., you know, delivered this finding. Ban Ki-moon has kind of who in many other instances where civilians have been slaughtered, and I'd give the example of Sri Lanka, which he was personally aware of in 2009, 40,000 civilians killed by a government, said almost nothing. In this case, he started pronouncing war crimes have been committed. In this closed meeting, he said Assad must be held accountable, and it's not clear to whom Ban Ki-moon himself is accountable, i.e. he's not a judge. He's shown a willingness to pronounce conclusions about reports he hasn't yet seen. And this is, again, not to kind of mix and match, but in the interim, and this didn't, you know, some of your listeners may be aware that the UN is accused, and quite credibly, of having brought cholera to Haiti, which has killed over 8,000 people. The UN issued a report exonerating itself. And so they don't see any connection. They think that they can issue a self-serving report to serve their own ends. So the people are supposed to accept this report and say, oh, of course, it's the UN, it's impartial. And it's just shown itself to be decidedly not impartial. And for once, these days, you know, in the last few days, you actually see Russia saying this report is a joke. And it's interesting, you know, the politics are that Ban Ki-moon, has, like Obama, is in a second term. So there's not really any kind of impeachment mechanism at the UN. But there's very few people in doubt that Ban Ki-moon is kind of a tool of the West.
Matthew Lee of Inner City Press, can you take us through the footnotes that indicate the discrepancies in regard to the results reported by the UN investigation team in terms of the two attacks that were investigated and the anomalies of the most lately discovered so-called evidence that may or may not be authentic after a period of rebel-controlled transit through the investigative territory?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We could. I guess what I've said, when the report first came out, before I saw this, its own admission of its limitations, I was pouring all over it. I think once you see a report say that, and in fact, during while they were there, the one good thing about, you know, social media can obviously be manipulated and things can be put up there, but there's also like there's people. So you always obviously have to take things with a grain of salt. But even in videos that the UN and US themselves are pointing to. There were the inspectors were like going into courtyards in Al Ghouta, and people were coming in with pieces of metal. I mean, it was a totally Rube Goldberg operation. And so I almost want to say, like, although I've seen very, and people can go online and find these, you know, extremely detailed rebuttals of things in the report. I'm not really sure that that's necessary. I think like it's not a question that it's not necessary. I'm at the point where I'll say. I'm not sure who you know what occurred on August 21st. And I think that's the most you can take from this. There's word that Syria has provided its evidence to Russia, and that Russia says it's going to now present it in front of the Security Council. It's turning into a big circus. I think it's and in a strange way, what everyone sort of forgets is that, and I think this was we can get into this, the sort of the sleight of hand of the Obama administration. I mean, everything has now come down. To this one event in Ghouta on August 21st, and it's sort of not just the killings on both sides leading up to it, but the fact that there are extremist opposition armed by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, the fact that the motive of many of the individuals behind the desire to focus on this incident is in fact either to arm those people more or to overthrow and depose and perhaps Gaddafiize Bashar al-Assad, all of this has been lost. And so you have this kind of, I almost think it's a mistake to comb over this self-effacing report too much to say, you know, even if that were the event, what would that, you know, to what ends are it being used, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Matthew, there was one detail that caught my attention about the presence in the rebel, or I might prefer to say Contra-controlled external invasion of Syria territory in regard to these attacks, of what looked like a pristine nose-in-the-dirt so-called Syrian munition that had been heavily trafficked between the time that the Syrian government permitted on the same day as the request the United Nations inspection, and there are controversial differences of people saying that it's real or it's fake, but did you see that detail, and can you help us understand that?
I mean, I'm staring at it. It's on page 20, and I see it does look like I guess what I want to say is, as much as I've tried, I've decided to. I'm not going to become an instant munitions expert. I mean, I've seen people out there that are, but I've seen them actually on both sides of this. I'll just say that it's a very. The paragraph that I read to you from the beginning, talking about how people were walking around with things and putting them wherever they wanted, I think that speaks for itself. And I think there's also it's often repeated in these days in the media the idea that. It's kind of a proof by, you know, negative proof. It's saying we can't prove that Assad did it, but we don't think the rebels have it, so it must be them. And that's just not that credible in the sense that, number one, there was already an arrest of some al-Nusra Front individuals in Turkey with sarin gas. Number two, there were definitely chemical weapons and delivery systems still in the possession of Gaddafi at the time that he was so abruptly overthrown. And these have been trafficked out of the country. You know, like crazy. And so there are a lot of theories out there. I have to say that I've heard of another, you know, a contractor, Bechtel, Georgia. I've heard many things. I've sort of like try to keep my nose to the grindstone and just say, how can the UN, which is actually, you know, one of its remaining sort of functions in these kind of situations would be to somehow stand up for international law to the superpowers, or in this case, the superpower. How can they, you know, demand and kind of browbeat anyone that asks them even questions about this report? It's sort of like, no, the report is indisputable. The question is like, in what way is it indisputable? Especially when it's not even, I mean, I think there's kind of a tag team effort here. You may have seen the report put out by Human Rights Watch immediately after the UN report. They say like, well, the UN report has facts but reaches no conclusions, but we can tell you, and they draw a few red lines on a map and they say Assad's brother did it. If this is the quality of their reporting, I mean, and I've seen them, again, I have, they sometimes on, where the stakes are lower, they can do much better work. And I've seen some good Human Rights Watch reports, so I'm not in all instances a doubter, but this is like the Super Bowl for them. This is the situation in which, and that, you know, they can put their imprimatur and say, they can say the things that the UN dares not say, but just exactly who are they to draw a red crayon on a map and say Assad's brother did it? You just have to do a little bit better than that.
Better to watch Human Rights. But the image of that so-called incompletely exploded munition reminded me no more of anything else than a Warner Brothers cartoon with an unexploded Acme Company dud with Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, what Ban Ki-moon is, absolutely, I agree. I was really, here's another like UN side detail that your listeners may not have been aware of. First, there was Ban Ki-moon declaring it overwhelming before he saw it. Then, over the weekend on Sunday in his townhouse on Sutton Place, just north of the UN, Ban Ki-moon received the report, which he'd already called overwhelming, by hand from the head of the inspection team, Åke Sällström of Sweden. And he invited a UN photographer, who I know, perfectly nice guy, up to witness the event. And they put on their website a photograph of a smiling Sällström handing the report to Ban Ki-moon. And as they should have known, or perhaps did know, when you blow up the photograph, you could read the front page. And so they got a whole 24-hour news cycle saying the UN has found that sarin was used and it's very troubling. And those who blew up the photograph were acting as if it was like a Pulitzer Prize-winning event to be manipulated in this way, you know? And it's like, and then once the job was done, they took the photograph down off the UN site. And there was nobody ever followed up to say, like, this is amateur. You know, it's like amateur hour. I think there's another way to look on this, which is less kind of conspiracy-minded. But, I mean, in defense of Ban Ki-moon, the best defense I could come up with for him is that he's desperate and that the UN feels itself being made irrelevant by, for example, President Obama saying, I don't need the UN to fire missiles at Syria, as he said and continues to believe. And so in a way, this is kind of a race for relevance by the UN. They're like, instead of saying, yes, you do, this is the law, they're like, don't worry, we can help you. please don't ignore us, because we're more than willing to debase ourselves by calling reports overwhelming before we see them, by flashing the report and then pulling it back, and then by browbeating anyone that doubts the report, so that the U.S. can say, well, the U.N. I mean, and when people say the U.N., often, what do they mean? The U.N. is a organization that's ostensibly run by 193 countries, all equal. Now, everybody knows there's a Security Council, then there's five permanent members, but it's not like the U.N. doesn't speak with one voice, obviously, you know? And so the Ban Ki-moon will try to sort of like get out in front. They've been kind of manipulating the press in such a way at the U.N. where normally there's like a noon briefing where people can ask questions and, you know, you may or may not get an answer. These days they've been preempting the briefings to say, no, today, the news today is Ban Ki-moon is having a press conference. And in one instance, he took only two questions. And they choose very carefully. I have to get along with my fellow correspondents, so I try to hold my tongue, but the questions are chosen in such a way that they all go the same way. So you're left, like I was there the day that the report came out, repeatedly asking, and you know, politely but loudly, you know, questions to Western delegations that were already had chosen, you know, AFP, Reuters, CBS, and the questions are all like, basically, when are you going into Syria? Why can't you send Assad to the Hague? But even by their own terms, this argument is not consistent. I mean, I'll give you an example. There's a big media cycle right now about the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, who is indicted by the International Criminal Court, coming to the general debate at the UN, and he's indicted for genocide in Darfur. Okay, if it's bad that he comes to New York, and he has every legal right to come and address the UN. It's like the U.S. has to let him in because it's an agreement between the U.S. and the UN. But if it's so bad that he comes to New York, why did the UN go and meet with him in Khartoum? The UN head of UN peacekeeping, Herve Ladsu, went and met with Omar al-Bashir in July. And there was not a peep out of Human Rights Watch. There was not a peep out of the U.S. mission to the UN. And so it seems it's almost like there's a deal between the U.S. and the UN, which is that they'll be soft on the UN. The UN can meet with war criminals. The UN can ignore war crimes. As long as the UN, when the chips are down, will lie through its teeth and then control the questions that are asked in this theater in front of the Security Council.
This is Earth Watch on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and our guest is Matthew Lee, senior editor of Inner City Press, based at the United Nations. And Matthew, let's take a look at the international narrative, and in particular, the alternate projections that are being made by Russia and Foreign Minister Lavrov, and the reactions to that.
Sure, absolutely. What people sort of somehow miss sometimes in all this is that the deal that was struck in Geneva the weekend before this report was released, it's the U.S., it's not just Lavrov, it's Lavrov and John Kerry. I mean, if the U.S. is kind of having it both ways. They struck a deal with Russia, which is entirely forward-looking in the sense that, you know, turn in a list of your chemical weapons in a week, allow inspectors in November, and have them out of the country or destroyed by the middle of 2014. And that's all the agreement provides. And that's all the U.S. got, and it's all it's negotiated for. Now the U.S., I think this is where I'm going to sort of back into this by saying there were other countries that were out in front saying, we need to invade, we need to bomb, which, for example, France. They were really left out on a limb because the U.S. didn't pursue the goals that France has said are the goals. And so you're left with now, they sent the French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius to Moscow to meet with Lavrov. Both of them came out, but it's as if France is kind of in denial. They're saying, we need this resolution at the Security Council, which will make any mistake, any arguable lack of compliance by Syria automatically trigger the use of military force. And not only is it that Russia would veto that and is opposed to it, but that's not the deal it struck with the U.S. That's not going to be in the resolution. There's simply no, it's not, and I think it's strange because if France really believes its position of you have to send Assad to the International Criminal Court and there has to be a Chapter 7 threat of military force at this time, then they should veto the resolution. They should, what the U.S. and Russia agreed to, France should, you know, for once, if it believes it, be the one to cast the veto. But they won't because it's not clear actually why they have the veto. I mean, you know, it's not clear why any of the five do, but particularly in their case, they don't want to be the one to use it because then people are going to say, why do you even have it? So basically Lavrov has taken his position is, if you read the agreement, even the U.S. didn't get any agreement to a Chapter 7 resolution at this time. It's kind of ramped up in the last about 48 hours. I think because the U.N. is pushing this report so strongly, he sent his deputy to Damascus, who said openly that he's received counter evidence from Syria, that he intends to present it to the Security Council, and that the U.N. report is simply not credible. Today at the noon briefing at the U.N., the spokesman was asked about this. And instead of just saying, you know, reasonable minds can disagree, which is sometimes a fine answer, he said, we're asking, you know, to find out if that's really what he said, because our report is indisputable. And it's like, no, it's being disputed. Your report is being disputed. It's kind of shocking to me that the UN thought that it could even veer from its mandate. I mean, the whole point initially it was just to say yes or no, were chemical weapons used? And then as it got closer in time, they started saying, well, it was going to really be an evidence-based narrative off which people could draw their own conclusions. And now you see what that means. The day after they put it out, Human Rights Watch is drawing crayon lines on a map and listing the name of Assad's brother. So I think Russia, things are kind of ramping up. But I think, I'm covering this, so I don't really predict so much, but I would predict that there is no way at this time that a Chapter 7 resolution threatening the use of force for lack of compliance and referring Assad to the International Criminal Court, there is absolutely no way that will pass. And that a lot of ink is being spilled and people are saying it has to remain in there. And the U.S. is in, the U.S. should really be asked, if it's now saying it wants those things, why it reached an agreement in Geneva between Kerry and Lavrov that doesn't provide for any of them.
Matthew Lee of Inner City Press at the United Nations. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And just one other detail. In regard to the United Nations report, is there a significant and useful distinction made between the anomalous treatment of the video victims that have been selectively released on the Internet in regard to whether it is military sarin, homemade sarin, chlorine, or other materials?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, I mean, there are some... You know, their presentation is not convincing on that, in the sense that even this jug sarin that al-Nusra was said to possess can obviously cause a lot of problems. So I don't, even this one thing of saying, okay, we're not going to say who used it, but we're going to say exactly what was used, it's not really addressed in it. The one thing that they also keep saying now at the UN is that, I guess this is trying to diffuse their problem with Russia, is to say, we're going to go back to Syria. This is just a preliminary report. That's one thing to remember when you read these stories about, like, the UN has reached its conclusion, is that actually they're trying to have it both ways. On camera, you can get a soundbite of them saying, this is indisputable. And then the next moment, they'll say, this was a preliminary report. We intend to go back. Yeah, it's not clear that they're going to be able to. Intend to go back and investigate what was the initial goal of the investigation was a place called Khan al-Asal, which Syria claimed that the rebels had used chemical weapons. And there was a Russian journalist called Anastasia Popova who had a video interviewing people that were there at the time, and as much as the UN has, pictures of spent shells on the ground. And this was the strange part. Like, it became, first the UN, and I followed this up, the UN claimed that they had taken in Anastasia Popova's video and evidence, and it was being made part of the evidence in front of Selstrom. And then I managed sort of, at the tail end of a press conference, but still in the press room, to speak with the UN, Angela Kane. She's the High Representative on Disarmament, and she was very dismissive of it. And she said, we couldn't really work with that tape. It was just very small. We really didn't include it. It wasn't technically feasible. So, I filmed this, and I put this on YouTube. I did my own social media and put it on YouTube. The UN went crazy and said, you couldn't. She, like, as if somehow she could be in the press room, but she's not on the record. And number two, that they didn't have to give a straight answer. You can't have it both ways. You can't throw evidence in the garbage can and then pretend that you took it seriously. And the same is going to come down now with what Syria provided. And in a previous Russia report, which they put in 100 pages. I'm not even saying all this to say, is the Russian report better than this? Is the Syrian evidence better? I'm not sure, but all I can say is that the UN was in no position, given the current state of evidence and of the process, to call this either overwhelming or indisputable.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're speaking with Matthew Lee, senior reporter with Inner City Press, based at the United Nations. And Matthew, there is the question of the ongoing rhetoric from the Obama administration in regard to the continuing threat of force, not only about Syria, but now most recently Iran. How is that being taken by delegates at the United Nations in regard to the UN Charter that, as I understand it, prohibits or proscribes the threat of force?
No, absolutely. When Obama speaks, people listen. But he basically, I think people were very surprised when he came out and said, because he went out of his way to say, in the case of Syria, it's not self-defense. And basically the state of the law in most countries' understanding, and I think the law, to the degree that there is one, is that the use of force is legitimate under the international legal system if it's in self-defense or if it's authorized by the Security Council. And Obama, in a way, he said this doesn't directly implicate our safety, but we're trying to enforce an international norm. Well, that's not a grant. The way to enforce an international norm is through an international organization, not out of a Lockheed Martin jet of your own invention. And so there's definitely pushback, but I think, the thing about U.S. power and exceptionalism is that as much as there's pushback, look at the NSA spying scandal. Most recently, the Brazilian president has canceled her meeting with Obama. I've attended in August these Security Council meetings at which many Latin American countries came up and said, you know, it's outrageous, but it's not, it's very difficult for, in part because the U.S. has a veto on the Security Council, but it really comes down to the law of the jungle, right? I mean, it's the only, the U.S. does these things, and then ultimately, you don't, you know, you'll hear complaints. But in terms of who's going to stop the U.S., I guess that would be my question. I don't say it in a defeatist way, but I saw, I think yesterday it was, Senator John McCain spoke at CFR and said, you know, Obama should have just done it and then just accepted the inevitable blowback. And I think he meant political blowback, like as if, you know, complaints, democracy, and the law are just kind of a side effect. But I'm not, you know, I think it really comes down to the question, one of the questions is, whether what the threat of Russia is Russia does have a base on the shore of Syria, you know, would they defend against such a missile strike? That's really it really is kind of a law of the jungle situation. You hear senators like McCain and Lindsey Graham saying, oh, they're not a credible threat, you know, we should just do it. And I think it's shocking to see. This is also, and again, I'm always looking, the U.S. is what it is, and you look at the UN, the Human Rights Watch, which is often, you know, as adjuncts of the U.S. in these matters, it's a very weird international legal system where resolutions, Security Council resolutions, are routinely cited against, for example, Rwanda. There's a lot of things said about you violated the arms embargo, you are allegedly, you know, assisting rebels in the DRC, and meanwhile, people are openly talking about funding rebels inside Syria. Like openly bragging about it, saying the U.S. says we're giving only MREs, but next week it'll be guns. Saudi Arabia giving guns, Qatar giving guns, and these resolutions, this whole kind of trapping of international law, sanctions regimes and sanctions committees, it turns out just to be a way to micromanage less powerful, mostly African states with a kind of kangaroo court. But when the chips are really down, the law is nowhere to be found.
What is your estimate of the viability of the tenuous agreement about Syrian weapons of chemical and mass destruction agreement?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, because I think even no matter what happens, even if Syria were to comply with everything that Russia agreed to on its behalf or not, you're going to hear it's clearly part of the strategy to claim violations of it at every turn, you know? So I think it's hard if people want to be hear about violations, and the question is, you can't violate it yet. There's no deadline that's yet passed. One can imagine a situation. Let's even say you get over the first hurdle. I mean, I'm sure if Syria turns in a list, it seems to me clear that there are going to be people saying the list is not complete. In fact, there's already people saying they transferred weapons to Hezbollah. There are already people saying they're in secret locations. So it's going to be this. The media game is going to become even more. The ball is going to be the carnival is going to be turning even faster and faster. Then you have the issue of it's up to Syria to allow inspectors, protected by who? It's not yet clear. And I've been trying to figure out. I've seen some American Congress people saying that the Russia should provide the troops. Then I can imagine other ones saying, well, you know, that's the wrong force. But if they go there, it is a war zone. So just as what's happened with these initial inspectors trying to leave the place, there's clearly an interest on the opposition side of this deal not being complied with. And so who's going to, you know, why wouldn't they shoot at the inspectors, right? So it's going to become, then the argument will, you know, again, this is, I'm prefacing all this by saying this is just sort of like looking down the road. The argument would be made, it's still the Syrian government's fault that they couldn't get out. So I don't want to be a fatalist, because I think it does seem that there's a reason that Obama sent Kerry to Geneva to cut that deal. So I don't know the mystery of it seems like he realizes a political loser, you know, or, you know, I mean, maybe you think that's naive on my part, but it would certainly seem to some people it would be worth trying this deal out to see if you could get this deal complied with. But there are so many people that want it to fail that it's going to, you know, the only thing is it basically comes down to this. Russia will continue to threaten a veto, so the U.S. will not be able to get a Security Council approval for a military strike. So you're back to the same question that we were a few weeks ago. Does the U.S., quote, just do it? And that's going to maintain. And I think if you even look at it from the Syrian side, it's not clear why they should start going down this road with unless the whole reason to comply with this deal would be that the threat of force is removed. But even if somebody verbally removed it, it's obviously there. But it hasn't even been verbally removed. In fact, it's being verbally reiterated daily. So I have to say that's the good thing about the world. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. But for all of the reasons that I've said, the compliance and confirmation of this agreement may be difficult.
Matthew Lee, we deeply appreciate your clarity. At this moment of the American news trance, have you any other thinking points that we might well consider?
Oh, sure. Because this news trance concept of yours has grabbed me. I mean, I think since we're both here in the United States, we see the American news trance, but it's really turned into a global game in the sense that, like, the one thing in covering the UN, it's almost like almost all media are state media in the sense of, and I think people should sort of, this is the one thing that I've learned since I've been there, and I'm not very popular among some there for reporting on it, but, okay, we'll start with an easy one. Agence France-Presse is the French press agency. So therefore, when you see, like, a resolution leaked to them, they don't even get that often. It usually goes to Reuters, but it came from, you know where it came from. And I had a personal experience of questioning in some detail the head of UN peacekeeping, who's called Hervé Ladsous, who's the fourth Frenchman in a row to have that position. And to be fair, the U.S. has held the political affairs several times in a row, and the U.K. has held humanitarian affairs several times in a row. But in this case, in fact, another journalist from Agence France-Presse filed a complaint with the UN about the way I asked a question to Hervé Ladsous. And, I can certainly raise my voice, but there was no profanity in it. In part, the question had to do with this same individual was France's ambassador to the UN in 1994 during the Rwanda genocide. And he, not even secret documents in the Security Council, argued for the escape of those who committed the genocide into eastern Congo. So it seemed like a pretty fair question to ask, how do you deal with that task given your current role now flying drones over eastern Congo? But apparently this is a complaint-worthy question. So, and then you go down the line, you see the same things, the UK will give its documents to Reuters. And this, so it's important, I think, when people, you really need, the one good thing I can say about if you're willing to put in the time, a UN report is not credible. Many of the kind of original sources do go online. And in fact, most governments end up having, which isn't to say that any one government is credible, but you can actually get, it's most important, I think, to get the original documents. And then, as Inner City Press, we try to, like, bounce around and, I guess, ask the questions that get the complaints filed and take it from there.
Matthew, we thoroughly appreciate here on Earthwatch the thoroughness of your investigative reporting at the United Nations. How might people learn more and be more conscious about world affairs through your work?
Okay, great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the thought. And I will say, it's the website is innercitypress.com. If people use Twitter, it's @innercitypress, all one word. I would also, I actually forgot to say this in the past thing, because of having these various run-ins with kind of not just media kind of manipulation, but actually outright big media attack on small media, or not small media, independent media. We also have founded an organization called the Free UN Coalition for Access, which defends, there was recently a journalist actually that came representing one of the Pacifica stations that people literally tried to cut their question off. So we, intervened and tried to make sure that at least there's the trappings of free speech and free press inside the UN. I mean, so that's called Funca, and that's at funca.info. So these are three sites you might want to look at.
Matthew Lee, senior reporter, Inner City Press, based at the United Nations. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and Matthew, thank you for an enlightenment.
Oh, thanks a lot. I love your show, so I'm sure we'll speak again.
receiver won't come and answer someday. I got three passports, other visas, don't even know my real name. On the hillside, trucks are loading, everything's ready to roll. I sleep in the daytime, I work in the nighttime. I got that and I get hard. This ain't no party, this ain't no disco, this ain't no fooling around. You're in the book club, I see me cheating.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI in New York and streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm Robert Knight. Up next, more on the Syrian war and domestic economy from independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, speaking last week in Madison, Wisconsin at the 12th annual Fighting Bob Fest conference, named after the populist tradition of Robert Fighting Bob La Follette.
These are somber times for the United States. All of you are more than aware of the discussions that are taking place in Washington about a war with Syria. And let me just say this about war. And let me just say this about aggressive action. I believe in war and aggressive action, and the time is long overdue that we declared war against high unemployment in this country and that we created the millions of jobs that this nation needs. Now, wouldn't it be a great thing if all of the media and all of the political leaders of this country were focused on how we create millions of jobs, how we rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, how we deal with the reality that real unemployment in this country is not 7.4%, but almost 14%. That youth unemployment, our entire generation of young people, high school grads, college grads, unemployment for them is close to 18%. Black unemployment for kids, young black kids, close to 40%. Let us declare war against unemployment, create millions of jobs in this country. And if we're going to go to war, let's declare war and defeat the trend toward a collapsing middle class. And let's declare war against young people in Wisconsin and Vermont and all over this country who are working for $7, $8, $9 an hour. Let's raise the minimum wage to a living wage. How's that for a good war? You want another war that will rally the American people? How about ending the national disgrace that the United States remains the only country in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right? How about a war for a single-payer national health care system? Now, you really want a war, if you're really hungry for war, you really want to be aggressive. How about a war that ends the trend in this country toward an oligarchic form of society, where a handful of billionaires control the economy and the political life of this country? Now, how about a war to fulfill the dreams of the American people and creating an egalitarian form of society rather than one in which the top 1% owns 38% of the wealth in America while the bottom 60% owns 2.3%. You want a war? Let's declare war against oligarchy. Now, if you really, really got your finger on the trigger and you really want to be brave and courageous and go to war, what about a war against Wall Street and their greed? Today, the top six financial institutions in this country have assets of over $9 trillion, which is equivalent to 2/3 of the GDP of the United States of America. They write 2/3 of the credit cards and issue 1/2 of the mortgages in America. And after their greed, their recklessness and their illegal behavior drove this country into the worst economic downfall since the Great Depression. You'll all be delighted to know that after you bail them out, they're now enjoying record-breaking profits. Now, how about breaking up the major financial institutions in this country? Now, that will be tough. Some people talk about Congress regulating Wall Street. Let me tell you, I am a United States Senator. That ain't the way it works. Wall Street regulates the Congress. Now, how about another war to save the planet and address the planetary crisis of global warming? How about standing up to the oil companies and the coal companies and telling them that we have got to transform our energy system. And when we do that, and when we move to energy efficiency, new forms of transportation, wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, not only can we cut greenhouse gas emissions, lead the world in combating global warming, we can create millions of jobs doing that. How about that, Wolf? And here's another war that I think we should fight. People fought and died in this country for democracy. And in my state of Vermont, at our town meetings, which we hold in March, what democracy means is one person, one vote. That's what it means. It does not mean a handful of billionaires controlling the political process in this country. So how about a war to overturn this disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United and move to public funding of elections? How's that for a war? Let me say a brief word on Syria. And I know that all of you agree with me. But in Syria now, we have a thug running that country who has made billions on the backs of his people and recently has waged chemical warfare against his own people. But let me tell you something about foreign policy and wars. I am old enough to remember Vietnam. And I remember like it was yesterday, Henry Kissinger standing in front of charts and maps telling us that if Vietnam fell, there would be a domino impact which would influence the entire world. Well, Vietnam fell. Right now, American corporations, after having shut down 50,000 factories in America over the last dozen years, are now investing $10 billion a year in Vietnam, where the average wage is a dollar an hour. What they told us about Vietnam was wrong. I remember Afghanistan, a country which virtually did not have an army. That was going to be an easy conquest. 11 years later, we are still in Afghanistan in the longest war in the history of the United States of America. And I remember Iraq, a war I voted against. And I remember President Bush standing on that aircraft carrier talking about mission accomplished. And after 4,600 men and women were dead, and as chairman of the Veterans Committee, I can tell you what I think most of you know. We have tens of thousands of good, decent men and women back here in the United States today who are suffering with traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, and we're trying to figure out how we deal with those issues. That was Iraq, which was, as I recall, a slam dunk, no problem. Point is that war has unintended consequences. The point is that when you get into a bloody and complicated civil war in Syria, it is going to be, in my view, pretty hard to get out of that war. Now, I know that for progressives in Wisconsin, in Vermont, and all over this country, these are difficult times. These are painful times. I think a lot of people are disappointed with the actions coming from the White House, whether it's this effort toward a war in Syria, whether it's the NSA and the other invasions of privacy, whether it is not standing up to right-wing Republican extremism. And I think that disappointment stretches all across this country. But I just want to say a couple of things about that. Martin Luther King Jr., whose great speech we marked the 50th anniversary of just the other day, reminded us of something very, very profound, and that is the arc of history is very long, but it tends toward justice. In other words, there are ups and there are downs. And as we sit here, stand here, and sit here this afternoon, all of us can think, those of us who are older or those of us who have read history, know that 30, 40, 50 years ago in this United States of America, our African-American brothers and sisters could not sit at lunch counters. Schools were segregated. Black Americans did not have the right to vote. I think it is fair to say that 20 or 30 years ago, nobody would have dreamed that this country would have gone as far as it has in not only electing our first African-American president, but re-electing him. So whatever you may be concerned about in terms of the White House, don't underestimate that enormous transformation in the United States in terms of race. Do we have a lot more to do with regard to race? Believe me, we do. We have made progress. In terms of women's rights, think back. Think back about where we were 40 or 50 years ago. Think about women who struggled for the right to vote, for legislation that protected their property rights, divorce law, abortion law, etc., etc. All of us are aware that around the country right now and in Wisconsin, there are attacks against women's rights. I am more than aware of that. But do not underestimate the fact that within a short period of time, I expect that half of the legislators in the Congress will be women, and that will be true all over this country. We have made progress in gender equality. And in the issue of gay rights, the progress has almost been breathless. Nobody would have believed 20 years ago that right-wing Republicans would be on the defensive in terms of gay marriage and other gay-related issues. Now, why do I say that? I say that because things change in ways that sometimes you cannot really predict. So while on a number of fronts, in terms of breaking down inequality in America, whether it's racial, gender, whatever, sexual orientation, we have made real progress. Clearly on the economic front, not only have we not made progress, we are losing ground significantly. And what must we do? First of all, what we must do is never give up hope. Never throw our hands up in despair and say, this is too hard. I can't do it. I'm tired. We have a moral obligation to our kids and our grandchildren to maintain the fight that those people have waged in this country decade after decade after decade. We simply do not have the moral right to say, sorry, I'm backing off. Too much depends upon our need to continue the fight. And let me just say something else about that, and this is important. There is a reason why the favorability rating of the Congress is at 15%. And the reason is not complicated. On issue after issue, Congress ignores the needs of the American people. And this is... And I want to talk about that for a moment, because this is not just Bernie Sanders talking. This is what the facts are. In Washington right now, there is some discussion by the president and some Republicans and some other Democrats to cut Social Security through a so-called chain CPI. That's what they're talking about in Washington. Do you know what the American people are saying? Don't cut Social Security. And there is some discussion coming from the big money interest about raising the Social Security retirement age to 70 and Medicare eligibility age to 70. And do you know what Democrats, Republicans, and independents are saying? no way. You can't make life harder for senior citizens who are struggling today. Do not cut Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. All over the country, that's what the American people are saying. In terms of tax policy, our Republican friends and some Democrats are prepared to support and continue an extremely regressive and unfair tax system. One out of four major corporations does not pay a nickel in taxes right now, and the kind of revenue that we're bringing into the government through taxes is significantly lower than it used to be. And do you know what the American people are saying across the board? They are saying, ask the rich and large corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes. And in terms of this serial, I will just tell you what is going on in the state of Vermont. Our phones are popping off the hook. We are getting many, many emails. 95% of the comments that we are getting say, do not go into war in Syria. So I think I am not going to tell you, you know, that everybody in the United States is a progressive, but I will tell you that on major issue after major issue, the American people agree with much of what we stand for. If you give the American people a long list of issues, do you know what issue they care most strongly about? And that is to create millions of jobs in America. That's what they care about. So our job, and it's a tough job, admittedly, but our job is to educate and to organize and to demand, for once, that the President and the United States Congress start listening to the American people, create the millions of jobs we need, rebuild the middle class, protect the social safety net, be aggressive in making sure that every American has health care as a right. That's what we need to do. Now, when you have a handful of billionaires exercising enormous control over our economy, when these guys are prepared to shut down a plant in Wisconsin or Vermont or any other part of America so they can make 5 cents more by going to China, they're prepared to do that. When you have a situation today where the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and these fellows can sit in a room and pour hundreds of millions of dollars into the political process, our job is tough. It is tough. But this is what I believe and what I have always believed, is that at the end of the day, if working people, if the middle class, if young people, if seniors, if people stand up together, we can beat big money. I believe that. But that isn't easy. That requires us to continue the struggle. Now, the last point that I want to make is that these are tough times in our country economically. They are tough times in our country politically. And I think the major struggle that we face is to deal with oligarchy, to take on the big money interests who have so much influence over this nation. But there is something else equally important that we have got to do, and we don't do enough of. One of the real concerns that I have about another war in Syria, in the Middle East, which would take us into You know, we've been to a war now for 11 years. We have a defense budget which is almost equivalent to the money being spent on the military by every other country on earth. What I worry about is a nation which continues to focus on war and forgets about the needs of ordinary people. And what our job, and this is a tough job, it's a tough job because you got CNN and you got all the TV out there and you got all the right-wing radio and you got all the newspapers out there. What our job is to go into our hearts and to rekindle a vision of what this country can be. And that vision should be a country where we lead the world and become an example, a model for the rest of the world in terms of doing our best to make sure that all of our kids have the best possible education, where college education is not the most expensive in the world, but that we create a situation where any person in this country, young or old, is able to get all the education that they need, regardless of the income of their family. Now, that's not utopian. That is not a utopian vision. It is a vision which says we want to lead the world in the quality of life that our people have. That's what we want to export all over the world. We want to have the best healthcare system in the world, which focuses on keeping us healthy, that treats us when we are sick, that is not by far the most expensive and wasteful in the system. Wouldn't it be great if we could show the rest of the world how you have high quality healthcare for all people in a cost effective way? Wouldn't that be an extraordinary export for the United States of America? And instead of tapping the phones or the emails of foreign leaders all over the world, wouldn't it be great if we invited those leaders to Washington to talk together how we're going to be extremely aggressive in cutting greenhouse gas emissions, coming up with the new technologies that we need? Think what that would mean to the spirit of young people. And think what it would mean as we focus on the simple question of how do we live well? How do we love each other? How do we create sustainable communities where people feel good about where they are living, are proud of where they are living? In other words, instead of being the major military power on earth, instead of being a country that exports weapons of death all over the world, let's export something very different, a new quality of life for all of our people. So, in the midst of these tough times, it is absolutely imperative, it is a moral responsibility that we keep the faith, that we continue the struggle. I am absolutely confident. I don't know when the day is going to come. It may not come, you know, in my lifetime. It may not come in your lifetime. But I have absolute confidence that the day will come when this country rekindles those virtues, those parts of our past that were the envy of the entire world, that we rally our young people and the energy and the idealism that they have, that we are going to be a compassionate people, that we are going to be in the vanguard of making this world a better place in which to live. But none of that happens unless we educate, unless we organize, unless we keep fighting. Thank you all very much, Wisconsin, for what you have done. Take care.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders at last week's Fighting Bob Fest in Madison, Wisconsin. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Continuing with today's theme, there's more to the Syrian crisis than the Obama-Kerry rhetoric of war and support for contra-jihadi terrorism, shaky United Nations reports, or even weapons of gas destruction. Today we have time for but a brief glimpse at the wider landscape of the petroleum and geopolitical issues surrounding the Syrian crisis. Simply put, it is also an energy war waged between two old rivals, the United States and Russia. We commend to your attention the fact that one reason Washington is attacking Syria and Moscow defending it is because of a pipeline that could change the economic balance of liquefied natural gas supplies to Asia and all of Europe. In short, one of several reasons for American, and especially French, antagonism against the Syrian government is because, in 2009, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad declined an agreement to run a natural gas pipeline from his now-enemy Qatar through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and on to Turkey for European markets, thereby breaking Russia's near monopoly on Eurogas supplies. Then, a year later, Assad compounded his offense to Western interests by initiating an agreement with the Shia-led nation of Iran to move Iranian natural gas through neighboring Iraq into Syria and points north and east by way of the pan-Islamic pipeline that would be expanded to run from Egypt to Syria to Lebanon to Turkey and ultimately on to Austria. As that agreement was signed, so did Qatar, France, and the United States escalate their covert war against the Assad government. Thus, once again, petropolitics are, as is so often the case, at the root of a Mideastern crisis. But then there is also the domestic leadership crisis in America, where plans for a Syrian war were made long ago, as former Iraq War Commander General Wesley Clark pointed out 2 years ago. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Now, General Wesley Clark.
What happened in 9/11 is we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have bipartisan agreement, we didn't have American understanding of it, and we had instead a policy coup in this country. A coup. A policy coup. Some hard-nosed people took over the direction of American policy, and they never bothered to inform the rest of us. I went through the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11. I couldn't stay away from Mother Army. I went back there to see Don Rumsfeld. I'd worked for him as a White House fellow in the 1970s. All this is in the book. And I said, am I doing okay on CNN? He said, yeah, fine. He said, I'm thinking about it. He says, I read your book, and he said, this is a book that talks about the Kosovo campaign. And he said, I just want to tell you, he said, nobody's going to tell us where or when we can bomb. Nobody. He said, I'm thinking of calling this a floating coalition. What do you think about that? I said, well, sir, thanks for reading my book. And, he said, thanks. That's all the time I've got. Really? And I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess it's they don't know what to do about terrorism. And so they think, but they can attack states, and they want to look strong. And so I guess they think if they take down a state, it will intimidate the terrorists. And you know, it's like that old saying, he said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem has to be a nail. Well, I walked out of there pretty upset. And then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office that says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, seven countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it. And I sat on this information for a long time, for about 6 or 8 months. I was so stunned by this, I couldn't begin to talk about it. And I couldn't believe it would really be true, but that's actually what happened. These people took control of the policy in the United States. And I realized then, it came back to me, a 1991 meeting I had with Paul Wolfowitz. You know, in 2001, he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, but in 1991, he was the Under Secretary of Defense for Policy. It's the number three position in the Pentagon. And I had gone to see him when I was a one-star general. I was commanding the National Training Center. I had met him one time. He said, if you ever get to Washington, come look me up. They always say that. Well, I was there in Washington. It was a Friday afternoon. I'd visited Colin Powell. He'd given me 5 minutes of his precious time and sent me on my way, and I was bored in the Pentagon, and I thought, I'll just go, who can I see? I think I'll see Wolfowitz. So I called, and up there, he was available. Scooter Libby came to the door. I met Scooter for the first time, and he brought me in, and I said to Paul, I said, and this is 1991, I said, Mr. Secretary, you must be pretty happy with the performance of the troops in Desert Storm. And he said, well, yeah, he said, but not really, he said, because the truth is we should have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, and we didn't. And this was just after the Shia uprising in March of 91, which we had provoked, and then we kept our troops on the sidelines and didn't intervene. He said, but one thing we did learn, he said, we learned that we can use our military in the region, in the Middle East, and the Soviets won't stop us. He said, and we've got about 5 or 10 years to clean up those old Soviet client regimes. Syria, Iran, Iraq, before the next great superpower comes on to challenge us. And it was like, you know, I'm coming out of the Mojave Desert. I've been training troops. I haven't been thinking geostrategy for some time. And suddenly a guy just sort of shoves this nugget at you. Well, you remember it. It was a pretty stunning thing. You mean the purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments. It's not to sort of deter conflict. We're going to invade countries. And, I you know, my mind was spinning. And I put that aside. It was like a nugget that you hold on to. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup. Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century. They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. It went back to those comments in 1991. Now, did anybody ever tell you that? Was there a national dialogue on this? Did senators and congressmen stand up and denounce this plan? Was there a full-fledged American debate on it? Absolutely not. And there still isn't. And that's why we're failing in Iraq, because Iran and Syria know about the plan. All you have to do is read the Weekly Standard and listen to Bill Kristol, and he blabbermouths it all over the world. Richard Pearl the same way. They could hardly wait to finish Iraq so they could move into Syria. It was like a laydown. Oh, our legions are going to go in there. This wasn't what the American people voted George Bush into office. Well, they didn't actually vote him into office, but it wasn't what many of the people who... It wasn't what he campaigned on. He campaigned on a humble foreign policy, the most arrogant foreign policy in American history. He campaigned on no peacekeeping, no nation building, and here he is with Afghanistan and Iraq. It's astonishing. So the root of the problem is not how many troops are in Iraq. Please believe me. Don't be mad, if you're a Democrat, at your Democratic congressman because they can't reduce the troops and frustrate the president. That's not the issue. And if you're a Republican, don't be mad at the Democrats because they're fussing with the troops. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you're an American, you ought to be concerned about the strategy of the United States in this region. What is our aim? What is our purpose? Why are we there? Why are Americans dying in this region? That is the issue.
I'm not your type. I'd like to ask you about LNG exports, national security. Currently, many of our closest allies in Europe are heavily dependent on Russian gas. Russia has used its natural gas resources for political leverage against these countries. Other allies are dependent on Iran's energy. Turkey, a NATO ally, receives 20% of its natural gas from Iran. In addition, Japan, one of our closest allies in Asia, imports significant amounts of Iranian oil. I've introduced bipartisan legislation, which is not always that common here in Capitol Hill, bipartisan legislation to expedite LNG exports to our NATO allies, to Japan and to others. Would you explain how LNG exports would promote the national security interests of the United States and its allies?
As briefly as possible. Well, in a nutshell, and you've already seen a microcosm of markets changing within Europe alone since what's happened with shale in North America started to happen. In particular, you had players that were invested all the way to the upstream end to bring natural gas in the form of LNG to the United States that were investing very heavily throughout the value chain to do that. And as soon as shale took off in North America, those supplies basically had to find a place to go. And the first point they were actually directed to was Europe. And what that did, it created pressure on the existing pricing paradigms, the existing contractual relationships between large buyers in Europe and Russians, in particular Gazprom. What that has basically led to is a destruction of the pre-existing pricing paradigm, which was one of oil indexation. Now what you've actually seen is Gazprom relent to a lot of their major buyers in Europe and actually allow an element of spot indexation in their pricing structures. And what that tells you is that when you add liquidity to a market, you change a lot. And what that means is it begins to challenge the revenue. It begins to challenge the revenue streams that Gazprom's value so much, and puts them in a very precarious position, because no longer do they have a captive customer. Now they actually have to think actively about price and negotiate on pricing terms, which basically changes their negotiating tactics, not only at the bargaining table for natural gas, but also around other geopolitical interests, vis-a-vis Belarus, vis-a-vis Georgia. So we can think about lots of different things that this begins to impact, because ultimately they don't want to lose market. So that's but one example. You can think about this spilling over into Asia as well, where the oil index paradigm has continued to persist until recently, when you actually see KOGAS actually signing up a long-term contract for a cost plus, a hub plus index for gas out of the Cheniere facility at Sabine Pass. What do you think they're going to do with that contract at every subsequent pricing negotiation they have? They're going to walk in, they're going to put it on the table and say, look, I want a gas index deal because I've got one and I've got a line of suppliers willing to provide it to me. It changes everything. It's about liquidity, and that's something that has been lost in a lot of the comments I've heard today, is there's been no discussion of what liquidity actually means for the way commodities are priced. Gas has been indexed to oil because it has not had liquidity. That's something that's changing in a dramatic way, largely because of what's happened with shale in this country.
And that concludes today's Geostrategic Edition of Earthwatch. We welcome your comments with an email to RKNIGHT. That's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI. We'll be right back.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Once again, and not surprisingly, the religious fundamentalists have got it wrong. They're all over at Noah, cursing it because it doesn't adhere to their notion of whatever that tale is supposed to be telling us. If they knew what was good for them, they'd be picketing Jonathan Glazer's new film, Under the Skin, which has absolutely nothing to say about the Bible, but instead strikes at the very heart of humanity's self-proclaimed status as the center of the universe. I think we know each other here. I think we're all steeped in enough true science fiction, or at least have read enough Tiptree, to all know that mainstream portrayals of alien intelligence, all that Star Trek, Star Wars stuff, are BS. If intelligent life exists elsewhere in the universe, and given the odds, I think that's likely, it probably won't be bipedal, it certainly won't be speaking English, it may not even be identical at all on a base biological level. And given that divide, the things that we consider key to the human experience, emotions, art, the entire sensuality of living, may be so far outside a true alien's perception as to be completely indecipherable. Remember the Horda? More like that, although we shouldn't even count on a core maternal instinct to connect on. At one moment late in Under the Skin, Scarlett Johansson, playing a creature whose origins are left somewhat ambiguous but are pretty clearly alien, sits in a diner and is served what must be the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake on Earth. She takes a large forkful of the dessert, slowly raises it, takes a mouthful, savors it, and instantly retches it out. That's Glazer's commentary on all those Starman moments when an alien is supposed to be seduced to the wonders of human existence as if a piece of Dutch apple pie was in itself enough to realign core perceptions and instinct. Perception, specifically an alien's perception, is at the heart of Under the Skin. The title can be taken literally. It addresses a revelation late in the film, but it also serves as a metaphor that works at several levels, addressing the seeming soullessness of Johansson's alien predator, who for the bulk of the film travels through Scotland in a white van, picking up men and luring them into an abandoned house where, for want of a better explanation, they are then slowly digested for purposes obscure. And it refers to her growing and potentially fatal curiosity for what drives her prey, all that reveling in the senses, in sexuality, in emotion. Johansson's alien, and by the way, none of the characters, to the best of my memory, is given a name, but Johansson's alien is the protagonist, and Glazer reflects her experience by filming this story at a cool, deliberate reserve. We're seeing an alien life through an alien's eyes, courtesy of her alien soul. An opening sequence specifically references 2001 A Space Odyssey, and there's a lot of Kubrick's clinical detachment here, particularly in the equal weighting between moments of true incident and the blank spaces in between, where we're being transfixed by some sumptuously photographed bit of scenery or of Johansson's impassive face. But there's also a whiff of Werner Herzog here in his regard for nature as an impassive force, neither sympathetic nor overtly antagonistic to the needs and wants of humanity. In this case, that's an observation that cuts both ways, referring both to the alien's regard of humanity, but also to Earth's response to the alien once she dares to try to go native. It'd be interesting to run Under the Skin in double feature with Aguirre, The Wrath of God, or, more pointedly, Grizzly Man, for which parallels are distinct and intriguing. On its own, though, Under the Skin is rapturous, mesmerizing, incisive science fiction, and a truly unique, what can I say, experience. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are now archiving these reviews over at Cinefantastique Online, so go on over to cfqonline.com and give us a listen.
Thanks, Dan. As a semi-regular listener of Hour of the Wolf, I appreciate your efforts and CFQ as well. Good to have a link. Oh, good morning. I'm Max Schmid. I'm sitting in for Jim Freund on Hour of the Wolf today. And the rest of the show will be jam wall to wall with radio science fiction dramas. We'll hear a two-part story from Escape, an adaptation of The Earth Abides by George R. Stewart. And we'll wrap the show up with another episode of X-1, another Robert Sheckley story called The Wind is Rising, perhaps inspired by yesterday's midnight snowstorm. All right, let's get underway with part one of Earth Abides, which was originally heard on the CBS anthology series Escape on November 5th, 1950.
You, finding life rather dull, dreaming again of exotic places, wishing you were somewhere else, we offer you Escape.
Today, Escape brings you one of the most unusual and terrifying stories of recent years. It is a story of such scope that the producers of Escape, in order to dramatize its full impact, will present it in two episodes. So now, with the performance of John Daner as Isherwood Williams, we bring you part one of George Stewart's powerful novel, Earth Abides. If a killing type of virus strain should suddenly arise by mutation, it could, because of the rapid transportation in which we indulge nowadays, be carried to the far corners of the earth and cause the death of millions of people.
If you should awake some morning, tomorrow morning, let's say, if you should wake to a man-dead world, where virtually all of human life had been dissolved from the face of the earth, leaving behind only buildings, bridges, machines, if you should awake to such a world tomorrow morning, what would you do? Where would you go? My name is Isherwood Williams. I was a student of ecology. I was in the Northern California wilderness gathering specimens of rock, plant, and animal life. I was alone, and had been for a month. Climbing up to a sharp ledge one day, I felt a sudden sharp pain in my extended right hand. I withdrew it under reflex and looked up, and there, a foot above my head, I saw him, a rattler, coiled, ready to strike again. Slowly, carefully, I lowered myself. I began to suck the poison from the bite. I wrapped a handkerchief about my wrist, tourniquet style, and headed for my cabin. There, I broke open my snake bite outfit, cut a neat crisscross in my hand at the point of the wound, and applied the rubber suction pump. Then I lay down on my cot. I felt sick. Sick because of the poison. Sick because I was alone. I was weak. In a few moments, deep, warm blackness closed in about me. I don't know how long I was unconscious, but I was awakened by the door.
Harry? Harry, look here. This one's still alive, I think.
Hello. I'm glad you came. I'm sick.
He's still alive, all right. Don't go near him. Come on, let's get out of here.
No, wait. I'm sick. Come back. Why did they leave me when they knew I was sick? What were they afraid of? I tried to stand. My knees were like sponge rubber. But finally, I was able to stumble to my chest of drawers. And then I saw the hammer, my rock hammer, resting on the top of the chest. And it suddenly became the most important thing in the world to me. If I can lift this hammer, I told myself, I will live. I wrapped my fingers about its handle, and I lifted it slowly, then let it down. I breathed a sigh of relief. I would live. In the morning, I felt better. I got up, packed the car, and headed for the nearest town, Hudsonville, about 10 miles to the south. They'd take care of me in Hudsonville.
Consider, if you will, the case of the rats that once inhabited Christmas Island, a small bit of tropical verdure some 200 miles south of Java.